estimated 10 million Americans age 50 and over have osteoporosis. That's a bone health disease, in case you weren't aware. And 43 million more people in the U.S. have low bone mass, putting them at risk for osteoporosis. And we're going to talk about how it's prevented and treated with our next guest. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Dr. Christina Morganti is a UW Health Orthopedic Surgeon and a faculty member in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And Dr. Morganti specializes in treating bone conditions and sports injuries, like my tongue, apparently. And she's here to help us today understand this and answer your questions. So if you have any about the treatment of osteoporosis, what you can do to prevent it, please join in the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So, Dr. Morganti, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You bet. And you're coming to us live from your treehouse. I love that so much.
Yes, I am. Hopefully you won't hear the geese and the birds out there talking to us. Yes.
Oh, that's just atmosphere. We love that. Yeah. That's no problem whatsoever. So as I'd mentioned, osteoporosis is a bone disease, but why don't you give us the actual technical description of it?
Yeah. Well, if you look at the language, osteo refers to bone and porous bone. So it really means a thinning or weakening of the bones. And the significance of that is people with osteoporosis are more susceptible to having a fracture, a broken bone. And that's interesting part about it is you might not know you have osteoporosis. It's kind of silent until something bad happens. So that's the whole thing with awareness. Osteoporosis month is coming up, so people know, hey, I better check and make sure my bones are in good shape and try to figure out before something catastrophic happens.
True, true. And it's something that happens as we grow older, right, in general.
Correct.
Why is that? What happens that causes them to start to deteriorate?
Well, interestingly, your bones, start as a baby, and you're just a bunch of cartilage, and that starts to calcify as your skeleton develops, and you start to add bone, and you're done adding bone sort of the end of your teens or early 20s. That's all you're going to get. And then in a person with balanced hormones, it stays about stable for about 20, 30 years, and then in women around the menopause transition, you lose estrogen, which is an important hormone for bone. And so particularly women drop off rapidly after menopause. And then with aging itself, there's a gradual decline in bone density, both men and women.
Does it happen with women a little earlier than with men?
It can. It's interesting. The menopause transition is becoming more and more out there and more people talking about it. And it can last about 10 years up to menopause. And then after, traditionally, the thought is after 49, 50, when people have menopause, you lose about a couple percentage points a year. And then men too, after 50.
Okay.
But women have this lead up going up to it that they may lose bone even earlier than when you actually know you're in menopause.
I see. So should people start getting tested at a certain time to see if their bone loss is maybe worse than others?
Yeah, I think, the recommendation is that all women 65 and over should have a bone density test, and men 70 and over should have a bone density test. However, if you have a risk factor for osteoporosis, particularly women, I'm going to turn off my ringer here. You should have
That was
have
not
one
a goose,
earlier.
Just so you know.
It's not a goose, it's a ringer. So if you have a family history, if you had early menopause, if you have had a fracture, a low energy fracture, that would indicate you should get checked even before that 65-year-old age.
Okay. But otherwise, it's 65. That's probably why I was told to get one this year. So it's an interesting process. It doesn't hurt. You get to lie down. It's kind of relaxing. Just super simple. Do you recommend that people get it? And when they do get it, what does it tell you?
So it tells you your bone density, which is one factor that describes how strong your bones are. Mm-hmm. So it's the most common way to assess your bone strength. And it actually gives you a measurement, how much mineral they detect in the bone. And typically, they measure your hip bone density, both hips and different areas of the hip. There's a part of it called the femoral neck, and then there's the total hip. And they also typically measure your spine, four levels of the spine, L1 through L4. And sometimes they measure your forearm. And then they take this number, this is how much mineral we detected, and they try to make sense of it by comparing it to a reference population. And then they describe that comparison by a T-score, which is actually the standard deviation, what your actual numbers are from this reference population. So if you're within one standard deviation, which is T-score plus one to minus one, that's considered normal. If you're more than 2.5 standard deviations below normal, minus 2.5 or lower T-score, then that's considered osteoporosis. And then there's this in between, you're not normal, you're not osteoporosis, so they gave it a name and they call it osteopenia. And people with osteopenia can still break a bone. In fact, because more people are in that category, osteopenia around the world, there are actually more fractures, people with osteopenia than osteoporosis, but your risk of fracture is higher if your numbers are lower. And then if you're younger, then if you're premenopausal woman or younger than 50 as a man, this comparison number isn't the T score they use. It's called the Z score. And that actually compares you to people your own age. And so for a younger person, if you're more than two standard deviations below the reference, it's considered low bone density for age. So Z score minus 2.0 or lower.
So when women go into menopause, is it a good idea to do hormone replacement therapy? Does that help with the loss of bone density?
It does help with the loss of bone density. And it's interesting that you bring that up because I don't know if you followed the past couple of decades. First it was in, then it was out, and now it's back in again. So, reviewing the data, every decision you make for your health is weighing the risks versus the benefits. And it appears upon re-review of the data, the risks are lower than one would have thought, and more women are opting for it, not particularly specifically for bone density, although some women decide that way, but for menopausal symptoms. And before November of last year, when the FDA removed their black box warning, we used to say, hey, if you happen to be on hormone replacement for menopausal symptoms, it's going to help your bone density, but we didn't typically prescribe it just for that. But now that the black box warning has been removed and people are educating themselves more, there are some women are choosing it for general health too.
Would the amount that's prescribed, the dosage, matter, if you have osteoporosis or not?
Yeah, typically, it's a decision you make with your doctor or your gynecologist, the dose. But most women are on about the same dose for the menopausal symptoms, which was protective for bone.
Well, that's good. Now, what about younger people? Are there things that they should be concerned about when you're young? I mean, we've always heard drink your milk. It helps to be in Wisconsin too. But are those kind of things preventative? Have that been proven, or is that just hearsay?
No, for sure. Because, like we mentioned, this your bone formation phase, so only into your late teens, early 20s, that is your chance to build as much bone as you can. And if you have unhealthy habits during that time, then you might not reach your optimal peak bone mass, right? So you want to do everything you can to do the best you can to build your skeleton to a healthy skeleton. And there are a lot of things you can do. So one is nutrition. So having enough calcium and vitamin D coming in, particularly for athletes or kids who might have eating disorders, enough calories coming in so you could still build the bone the way you're supposed to, enough protein, enough exercise, weight-bearing exercise. And that's been an issue with more electronics and more sedentary lifestyle of the kids. Also, kids who are this idea of sports specialization. So at an early age, you choose one sport. So you're doing the same repetitive motions over and over. For example, a kid chooses running, just goes in a straight line. Then they lack the differential load bearing in different directions that affects the geometry of the bone. So there's a new movement to remind kids to do multi-directional sports, varied sports, so your bones don't develop for just one thing. So you can do many things, and then you'll have not only denser bones, but a better geometry bones.
So that'll make your bones stronger as you get older, but does it also keep them stronger when you're younger too, so you're less likely to have a break?
Theoretically, well, kids, I will say kids don't usually get the osteoporosis type fractures. That usually it's a traumatic type thing. Some kids get overuse injuries, particularly these kids doing lots of sports and not eating well enough or having training errors or equipment errors. So that does help them for sure.
But definitely drink your milk.
Drink your milk,
So
right. And
drink
I'd
your
also say if these benefits last into adulthood. So for example, actually Dr. Chappell, our chairman at Wisconsin, and I did a study years ago where we looked at gymnasts and then she followed them for decades into adulthood. And the kids who had better bone density as children still had it into adulthood. So you're creating your bone geometry and your bone substrate then, so you have a better reservoir. So when you start to lose later, you're in better shape.
Well, that makes a whole lot of sense. But can we, if we start taking supplements and things as we're older, is that going to make a difference? Is it going to make the bone loss? We're not going to gain more, but is it going to make it less? Is it going to slow it down? I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, so that is like a very complicated question.
Oh, great. Right
So,
before we have to break for news.
okay, you tell me. Yeah.
We can save it for after that for sure. I tell you
Okay,
what,
you want
let's
to?
do that.
Yeah.
Let's save it for afterwards. We are talking with Dr. Christina Morganti. She's a UW Health orthopedic surgeon and a faculty member in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And we'll be back with her, but we'd love to hear your questions and comments. So give us a call, 800-642-1234. We'll be back right after the news with more. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today, and we're talking about osteoporosis with Dr. Christina Morganti. She is a UW Health orthopedic surgeon and faculty member in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And all of our lines are filled right now. We've got a couple of emails to get to, so we'll get right to it. And as we left, we were talking about supplements, etc. As it happens, we do have some calls about that. So let's take that first before we get into some things that maybe we didn't cover. So let's go to Barbara in Glenwood, Iowa. Go ahead, Barbara.
Thank you for doing this program. And please tell Larry, I hope he feels better soon.
Oh, he's probably listening, but I will be happy to forward that on to him.
Thank you. I'm 79 and my husband is 80, and we both had mothers with osteoporosis, so I've been followed out. So I have osteopenia. He is taking, and he is getting monthly infusions now from a neurologist for relating to mitochondrial breakdown, and that doctor is very concerned about the development of osteoporosis. But so they all want us to take supplements, but I get confused when I go to my favorite drugstore and try to get a buy one, get one free product, and it says there's a calcium that's 600 milligrams, one just 500, one with D3, one without D3. So it's all very confusing to me. How much, what should we take and how much should we take specifically?
I don't think she's alone in that, Dr. Morgandy.
Yeah, I think this might be a long answer, so I'm sorry.
That's
But
okay. We have a half an hour.
okay, perfect. Because this goes back to the question that Jill asked me, because you asked me, will supplements help decrease the risk of fracture? And that there's a difference between that and is overall nutrition going to help? And the thinking is that having enough, particularly calcium and vitamin D, is important for bone health and will help. However, the thinking is that all the research studies that are so conflicting, and some say take this much and that much, and recently they changed the recommendations, they reduced it down, and they said some people should and some shouldn't because the research is conflicting. So some research studies have shown it helps with reducing fracture and improving bone density, and some have not. And some of that may be because the thinking is that, say, you already don't have enough calcium or vitamin D, then supplementing that or having enough in your diet is going to help. It's going to get you to what you need. But say you already have enough and you take more, well, that's not maybe going to make that much of a difference. So when they do a study of people, they don't know where they started. Sometimes it kind of drowns out the difference. But the thinking is that absolutely, the answer is yes, adequate nutrition is important. And the question really is, well, how much is adequate? And based on these recommendations that keep changing, and how do you get it? And the recommendation is typically to get it from food if you can, except for vitamin D is difficult to get from food. So many people need a supplement. But currently, the recommendation is for people with risk of bone health, like you and your husband are, that may need a supplement. And there are two ways you can make a recommendation. One way is to make a blanket population recommendation, like they just did. And they just said everyone should have 600 units of vitamin D a day. International units is how they're out there. And if you're over 70, you should have 800 international units. So that's one way to do it. And that still is conflicting because patients are different and some people have risk and some people take vitamin D and some people have sunlight and some people wear sunscreen. It's confusing. The other way to make a recommendation is making an individual recommendation from your doctor after they check a blood level to see what your actual blood level of vitamin D is and then see if you lie in the recommended level and recommend your supplements based on that. So if you have a high risk for bone health, it's good to talk to your doctor and get a level and see, do you need more than you're already getting from your typical food that you're getting and sunlight, and then supplement from there if needed. Other nutrients, not vitamin D, like calcium and other nutrients, are easier to get from food. And if you can get it from your food sources, that's preferred. But if you can, a supplement is just fine. Mm-hmm. And so the other issue with supplements is that it's not that well regulated like drugs are. So it's hard to know exactly what you're getting in the pill. And so normally I tell patients there's sometimes a little ribbon on there, blue ribbon that says it's been reviewed by the RDA. So that is a reputable source. And then if you want to follow the population-based recommendations to start with, someone your age and your husband should start with 800 international units a day. And then I might talk to his doctor specifically about measuring a blood level. It's a vitamin D25OH level, and they can tell you, hey, where does my vitamin D store level live, and should I have more?
Okay, great. Well, that didn't take a half hour, so I think you did really, really well,
doctor. Okay, good.
Thank you, Barbara. Good luck with that, because I agree with you. It is confusing. Let's go to Pat in Green Bay. She has something to say about vitamin D, too. Go ahead, Pat.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for doing the show, and I want to chime right in on what you just said about vitamin D. My own story, my bone health is fine. But we just, I requested a vitamin D level from my physician because my primary care physician, because it's not normally part of your blood work when you go in for a physical. Although I've read in the literature that it ought to be, that more than half the population of the United States in age 60 or higher is deficient in vitamin D levels in our bodies. And I was found deficient. I was only at level 26, and I think 50 is the normal circulating vitamin D level you're supposed to be at. And so I'm taking 5,000 units, 5,000 IUs a day, supplemented with K2. And I hope you can talk a little bit about K2 also as a boost for vitamin D3, because I was told that your body needs to direct your vitamin D to your bones, not your heart. So K2 is kind of crucial there. And my husband, I requested his vitamin D to be checked after he had knee surgery, and it took him a long time to recover from, it was knee replacement. But nobody thinks to check vitamin D levels before such a surgery. I think that's odd. His D level was zero. It was tanked. It was, I mean, you know, so no wonder he was suffering.
Wow.
So thanks. Thanks for doing this.
Okay, thank you, Pat. Wow. Can you, vitamin D zero? I mean, my gosh, how does that even happen? So what was your reaction to that?
Well, I have so many things to say about that, actually. First of all, if you're deficient in vitamin D, I don't know if you remember hearing about like the kids in England back in the war that had rickets, or with Industrial Revolution with the smoke from that, the blocking out the sun, they had rickets. And that's what the vitamin D deficiency, the insufficiency is. And it could be rickets, and that could be painful, actually. So sometimes your vitamin D level is so low, it's a source of pain. So it's good to check it. The recommendations that just came out, which are confusing, I think, is that vitamin D, they just said that you shouldn't screen for vitamin D in the population because it hasn't been shown to definitively help change health for many things that it's been claimed for, like immunology and cancer and things like that, except for bone health. So if you have risk of bone health, you should check your vitamin D. They recently said someone over 75, but I think it's a good idea to get it checked. And then if you were to start supplementing, it takes about 3 months for the level to equilibrate to see if you got the right dose. So after starting it 3 months later, maybe check another one to see if you got up too much or too little and if you hit your target. The actual range of normal is between 30 and 80 currently. That's what it is. So we usually aim for the middle, like between 40 and 60, usually around 40. But if you're over 30, it's considered sufficient. So a level of 26 wasn't too bad, but I think it's a good idea to get your level up a little higher. Will help you. Vitamin K, I think you talked about that one. There is not as much extensive research on vitamin K as calcium and vitamin D. However, it is important in making the collagen for bone, and there's a thought that it may help the whole process because you have to make the collagen the substrate, then you have to mineralize it, which is what vitamin D helps get that calcium there. So it may help. And you just have to be careful about the consequences. So for example, vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin E, vitamin K, they're all fat soluble vitamins. So those get stored in sometimes vitamin A and vitamin D, for example, can compete for receptors. So you might, if you took more A, you might not be able to bind the vitamin D as well. But I think many practitioners think having a vitamin D with a K in the same supplement is a good idea, but it just hasn't been as strongly supported. There's just not as much out there as there is for calcium and vitamin D.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Pat. We appreciate that. Pilar in Madison emailed to say that she is 56 and in early menopause, and she has been told that bone density testing will not be covered by her insurance until age 65, but she wants to know how her bones are doing now as she weighs the risks and benefits of starting menopause hormone therapy. Do you have advice on where to get testing and what type of test to ask for? And if she needs to, you know, if she needs to get it outside of insurance.
Yeah, well, part of it depends on your insurance. So Medicare covers it for women 65 and over. And many of the insurances do cover a DEXA scan or bone density scan, same kind of name. If you have a risk factor for osteoporosis and are younger than 65. So, for example, you're a woman postmenopausal, that's a risk factor. So most insurances would typically cover it, and you'd ask for a DEXA scan or bone density test. I would say if for some reason it wasn't covered, to be honest, it's not that expensive of a test. Sometimes it's less than $100, not that much more than an x-ray. But someone who's 56 typically, or if you had any risk, a family history or a Caucasian woman, or they probably would be covered.
Okay. So just call.
Yeah.
Sometimes that helps. That helps. Janice in Appleton, let's go to you next. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Excellent program. I am a 66-year-old, very active woman. I lift weights twice a week. I practice yoga 5 days a week. I do biking, walking, gardening, very, very active. I've recently been diagnosed with osteopenia, and I am taking 2,000 milligrams of vitamin D daily. I'm just wondering what else I can do to reduce my risk of getting osteoporosis.
Preventative.
Yeah. They're doing a really great job, so I congratulate you on that. And I understand your reason for wanting to prevent osteoporosis because you're active, you have an active lifestyle, you don't want to be sidelined by fractures or a loss of function. And a lot of women who think about this and this idea of, they call it successful aging, not usual aging, but successful aging, and you're sort of on your way to that. So this, the cornerstone of maintaining your bone health are really five things. One is nutrition. So getting enough calcium, preferably from food, having adequate vitamin D intake, enough calories coming for an active person, having enough calories and protein coming in. And so an active person sometimes needs to be on the higher end of the recommendations. And, you know, our Secretary of Health, Mr. Kennedy, increased the protein intake. So now it's up to about over 1.5 milligrams per kilogram a day. So enough calcium, enough vitamin D, enough proteins, enough calorie nutrition-wise, and then enough weight-bearing exercise, which you are terrific. And then avoiding poison, they say. So, for example, smoking. No, not good. And then alcohol, they used to recommend no more than 2 drinks a day. But to be honest, now it's the less you have, the better, because that's kind of poisonous to the bones. And then sometimes there are medications you are on or have to be on. Like, for example, if someone had to be on prednisone or some of those medications, a big one is PPIs for antacids. If you had a way to get off those, if you have to be on them, fine. But if you had a way to substitute or get on something else, that would help preserve your bones. And then the last two things is, one, making sure you don't have a secondary cause of osteoporosis. So, for example, if you didn't know you had celiac disease and you weren't absorbing your nutrients well, or if you were low in vitamin D and if you had something correctable. And every time we see a patient that we're evaluating for osteoporosis or they've had a fracture and we're worried, hey, why did this happen? We always look for the common things that could cause it. If you haven't had a fracture and you have osteopenia, you probably don't need an extensive blood test, but a vitamin D level would be good, and a dietary review. And then the last thing is medication. And typically that is reserved for people at higher risk for fracture, someone who's already had a fracture or has low scores or a family history or a lot of medical problems. There is now a school of thought that's developing since the recent recommendations on postmenopausal care, and some women are interested in prevention. And there are preventive doses of medications if you chose to take one of those. So, for example, Fosamax, the famous one, you know, when it came out, it was a 10 milligram a day dose, and they changed it to a once a week 70 milligrams. But there's also a half dose, and that used to be prescribed for prevention. It kind of went away a little bit, the prevention thoughts, because we were so concerned with the very serious highest risk people. But now people are more concerned about the successful aging. And if they wanted to consider that, it's something you could talk about with your doctor.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that call, Janice. Let's go to Lisa in Madison.
Hi there. Thanks a lot for having this program. It's very timely for me. I'm a 77-year-old woman. I've had osteoporosis since 1993, so for 33 years. I was on HRT for 10 years, then on Fosamax, Forteo, Avista. In 2018, I started the annual injection infusions of Reclast, and I took that for 5 years with a one-year holiday in between. I have fractures, compression fractures at T4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. I have just recently had a two-year holiday from the Avista. So I had heard that you should not take, Reclast, that you should not take Reclast for more than 5 years. So that's one question. Would that be a good thing to go back on the Reclast?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It sounds like your doctor's really been watching you very carefully over the years, and you've had a lot of help for your bones. The Reclast is one of the bisphosphonates, so the same class of drugs as Fosamax, Boniva, Lendronate, those. And so the risk with those that people worry about that have made the recommendations to limit the use of it are the possibility of an atypical femur fracture and osteonecrosis of the jaw. And that is where the atypical femur fracture is, where your hip breaks at a little bit unusual location than typical, and sometimes they're slow to heal. And the thinking is if they've been noticed to people on reclast or Fosamax for more 7 years or longer. And so for that reason, the recommendation was to take these drug holidays. And the only medications that really are, you're able to do a drug holiday and not risk the loss of the benefit of it, are these bisphosphonates, because they bind to the bone, they stay, and they protect it, and they slowly dissipate. So there's not an abrupt loss of it when you stop taking it. So typically for reclass, you would take it in series, for example, 3 years, and take a holiday and maybe go back on if your numbers say you should. So it's not 7 years total in your life, but it's 7 years sort of consecutively. So it sounds like your doctor's watching you, and if you had 3 years and then a break and then back on again and now a break, it might be time to talk about having it again if you're high risk.
Okay, well, Lisa, thank you. And wow, that's amazing. Sounds painful with all those fractures. Is that kind of typical, or is that an atypical result of person with osteoporosis with the spinal fractures?
Well, you know, what I didn't ask is if those fractures occurred while on therapy or before the therapy started. That was okay. Not, I should have asked.
Lisa, yeah. Are you still there?
I sure am.
Yeah. When did those fractures happen?
Over time.
So over while...
time. In 05, I had the... I had 4, 5, 6, and 7, so since 2005.
So while on medication, yeah.
So once you've had one compression fracture, the risk of a second one is much higher. One, because you've been identified as a risk for fracture, so the weeks are obviously weak because you broke them. And then the biomechanics change. So a compression fracture to spine, it's typically a rectangular bone, and it kind of compresses in the front, so it looks more like a wedge or a piece of pie. So then the levels above and below who haven't fractured yet also have more force on the front there. And so that's how you can get sequential fractures. And the taking a therapy like a reclass or the others improve bone density, but they decrease the risk of another fracture by about 50%. So they don't make you bionic, but they decrease the risk. And it sounds like if over the past 30 years you had, 5 fractures, it's hard to say exactly how it timed with the therapy, but I'm thinking your therapy is helping you. It could have been worse.
Yeah. Okay. Well, like I said, Lisa, thank you for the call. And it sounds like your doctor definitely knows what they're doing. So thanks for sharing that. Let's just take a email before we have to say goodbye. Gail in Madison emailed to say that they have estrogen positive breast cancer. So she's leery of hormone supplementation. Gail's, however, taking, bear with me, bisphosphate. Can you discuss whether collagen peptides are useful?
I'm sorry, could you say that one more time?
Okay. So she has estrogen positive breast cancer, so she's leery of hormone supplementation. She is taking bisphosphate. Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you discuss whether collagen peptides are useful?
Okay. Yeah, bisphosphonate are the drugs we were just talking about, reclass and bisphosphonate. And yeah, as someone with estrogen-positive breast cancer, you wouldn't be the candidate for hormone replacement typically. I really can't. The peptides and the collagen are sort of new and coming out there, and there's all kinds of claims that they do a lot of things, and I don't think the research is strong enough on bone to tell you that way. Maybe.
Okay. Yep.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, that's a problem with new drugs. You just never know, right? So, Dr. Morganti, you have shared so much information with us. We really, really appreciate it. Calls we didn't get to, and I apologize. So we definitely will try to get you back on again.
Okay.
It's obviously a topic that people are concerned about, and we appreciate you sharing your time with us today. Thank you.
No problem. Yep. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Dr. Christina Morganti is a UW Health orthopedic surgeon and faculty member in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And up next, we're going to talk to the danger of contracting blastomycosis mycosis outdoors with Dr. Bruce Klein. So stay with us for that.